time is drawing near. Brothers, sisters, please get ready. Brothers, sisters, please get ready.
Welcome to Bending the Arc. This is listener-supported KKRN Community Radio out of Round Mountain, California. My name is Sharon Brizolera, and Bending the Arc is a show sponsored by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, and it's dedicated to being in conversation with individuals and organizations working for fair and equal justice in Shasta County. And today, I have the pleasure of speaking to Hill Country Community Clinic's Mobile Crisis Outreach Team. And I'm going to have them introduce themselves to you, and we'll have plenty of links in the show notes so that you can learn more. So we'll start over here with you, Tammy. And if you could please introduce yourself, tell us your name, your position at Hill Country within the Mobile Crisis Outreach Team.
Okay. I'm Tammy Allen. I'm the Behavioral Health Director at Hill Country, and I am a licensed clinical social worker and was a part of helping to develop this program as one that is embedded within sort of several layers of programs aimed at helping people in a really holistic kind of a way, really an integrated care approach that healthcare centers all over the place have taken on as kind of a critical path to doing healthcare better. And certainly our commitment at Hill Country is to partner with others in the community and to wrap around the most vulnerable people and get them the right kind of help at the right time.
Mm, and that's the whole person care. Mm-hmm. That's part of your...
Yeah, really looking at people with higher complexities in terms of their needs. They may have more serious mental health kinds of issues or addictions or serious health issues or many layers of that, and then add to that really adverse life experiences at the same time, and you can have any kind of crisis emerge. And so we developed a kind of an array of services to better meet a continuum of care here in Shasta County.
Thank you. Nick, what about you?
My name is Nick Zapponi. I had the opportunity to be involved in the rollout of Mobile Crisis when I was in graduate school, and then have been able to continue to be involved in a clinical role since then. I also am the clinician at our care center, our walk-in mental health crisis center.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. John?
Yeah, my name is John Luoma. I'm an associate clinical social worker, and I'm one of the two clinicians full-time on Mobile Crisis, and I've been doing this for coming up on a year now.
Great. And you know, several of you mentioned some of the other services. And just so that, you know, listeners know that Hill Country has a lot of primary health, dental, urgent health care, chiropractic services, and the Center of Hope that we might get to. But we're focusing on behavioral health and counseling services today. So you spoke a little bit about it, but could you give us an overview of those services?
Yeah, these are my babies. So,
yeah.
So historically, you know, going back 35 years, over 35 years ago when the clinic started, just by a group of local friends, there was really a commitment to having a whole person approach. And that means in rural healthcare, you bring in everything. Doesn't matter. It's not just your aching back or your infection or whatever. It's all of your family issues that you're struggling with. It might be a kid that's having difficulty in school or addiction issues, or a parent or grandparent that's presenting with all kinds of challenges. And so that all comes into the primary care setting. And over time, you know, there's sort of a necessity to develop, bring in specialists in certain areas. Behavioral health being a part of that, mental health. Behavioral health is kind of the umbrella of both mental health and addiction treatment primarily, but it's also, it extends out to really wellness and recovery in a wider sort of way, living as well as you can no matter what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that we all have ups and downs in our lives and may need help. Mm-hmm. So we have evolved to have behavioral health services in the primary care clinic. We have supplemental to that traditional therapy, psychotherapy. We've extended out into the schools in eastern Shasta County and have therapists in the schools. And then beyond that, it's really been in response to community need and what people are coming into the clinic and saying doesn't exist that is necessary. And we've evolved teams that have case management support, some wellness centers, our walk-in urgent mental health resource center, and the most recent has been what we call complex care teams, which is really intensive case management embedded within broader specialties, as well as the mobile crisis outreach team.
And Nick or John, is there anything you wanted to add to that? Anything that surprised you or that you really liked when you first came to Hill Country?
Well, I was really drawn to just the holistic approach at Hill Country, the fact that you do have therapists and substance use counselors and a dentist and a doctor all working together, and even the extension of the care center and mobile crisis, that we really are able to wrap around folks in a way that I haven't seen in organizations I've worked with before, that I think is really powerful. And you get to see people have their needs met in ways that support their well-being moving forward and also prevent those crises that we often get called out to.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think I've always been drawn to integrated health, and I think Hill Country does it kind of in a unique way with all of the different disciplines working together. I think also Hill Country, their mission statement starts with the term with kindness. And I think what I was really surprised by, as I started at Hill Country as an intern in graduate school, and I think what I was surprised by is you spend a lot of time learning complicated interventions as a clinician, and honestly, a lot of the time, what I was surprised by that it starts just with kindness, and so they were kind of already on to the intervention right there.
You mentioned the word recovery, and it just really strikes me in our community. At this point, we often think about substance abuse, recovery, but there are all kinds of levels of recovery around community level trauma, like the fires, around the pandemic. Had those experiences broadened how you approach recovery? Or,
well, I think from a mental health perspective, recovery has a much broader definition. Culturally, we are drawn toward the idea of addiction recovery, but certainly, with a broader lens, you can think about the fires and the collective trauma that we shared, and we still get calls on a regular basis to the mobile crisis outreach team with people that are still struggling due to their tremendous losses and kind of the horror of that experience and the aftermath, the still continuing kind of cascades of difficulty related to that. So there's trauma recovery. Yes, there's addiction recovery. There's if you go through any kind of difficult life experience, there's a recovery period. You can think about recovery from a health problem. You know, if you have a surgery, you have a recovery period. And so, when you have a broad definition of health, recovery is a part of that. In no matter whether the injuries or the ailments come in a physical form or some other.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. So the SEJC, Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, has been especially interested in your work with the outreach team. Can you tell us a little bit about when you began that outreach and what was it that prompted Hill Country to step into that role?
So gosh, that's a big question. I would say the answer, it started many, many years ago, and certainly it's actually rooted in the personal stories of staff and patients who have experienced really terrible things when they've gone through their own crises, whether it's ending up in a hospital, ending up interfacing with law enforcement in a way that was really not helpful and often harmful, and sometimes with really tragic outcomes. And that's that kind of laying the foundation for that and saying, what can we do to help? And that's Hill Country's evolution has involved that kind of consideration to say what's happening in the broader world that is also happening here. And then what can we do to help? If not us, who? And we definitely prefer for other people who may be more effective to take that on if with some encouragement, if they're willing. And where not, then we'll say, okay, what can we learn and accomplish together? But the stories really, it's the personal stories of tragedy that, and some of which we've seen in the news, really, especially over the last decade, there's been a lot more media attention to the tragedies that have happened related to mental health issues or some other kind of life circumstances that cause somebody to, get it resulting in a 911 call that,
leads to use of force.
Yeah, use of force or landing in a care facility where it's not caring and compassionate, where there's further harm that can happen in some settings. Mm-hmm. And our first goal of our mobile crisis outreach team from the very beginning was to improve the experience of people who are going through some kind of a crisis so that meeting with a kind, caring response under those conditions can make a difference and reduce the harm in that kind of a way, actually be the antithesis of what people are expecting.
Mm-hmm. So it's rooted in the stories, and there was the need, mm-hmm. and no one really stepping up. And I know there were some models that our community and others had looked at, like Cahoots and in mm-hmm. Oregon. What kicked it off, the actual dedicating staff? And
yeah, so when we started the care center, that was in 2016, I want to say, there was kind of a hope to eventually be able to extend it out into, put wheels on that office and get out in the community, knowing that not everybody can get in or has the will to get in. Mm-hmm. So and there were stories of people really being angry and frustrated. I mean, I can't understate that. I feel really like there's a lot of idealism that goes into social transformation efforts, but the action that it takes and the kind of the persistence and the drive to do the hard work often comes from a place of heartbreak and real devastation and fury. Like something must change. So so that was there when we sat down and kind of brainstormed what we were going to do. Those were the kinds of stories that came out with a lot of tears. And then, it's true. What, that never doubt that a few committed, I say friends can change the world, but it does. Mm. So that's kind of the drive behind. And then it was really already having established partnerships within the county system, which we've had a really remarkable experience. I know there's frustrations most certainly, but in different ways, but we've had a really I think exceptional kind of experience partnering with other agencies and organizations throughout the county. There's a lot of people in this community that are vigorously interested in making things better. Mm. And it's just a matter of finding each other and finding some glue to hold you together. It's hard when there's so many competing interests and demands, but there's enough opportunities came, the right connections. In some ways, a gift of COVID, there are gifts that come with COVID in that it drew everybody together in a common crisis. Mm. And the fires before that. So mm-hmm. that there's a spirit of teamwork that comes out of that. And that kind of just paved the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it sounds like from what all of you are saying too, a dedicated focus on relationship building, both to hear from people about their experiences, but in terms of partnerships.
Yes. So we've grown, Hill Country has grown through like literally sitting in session with families, individuals, and hearing their stories and saying there's some missing pieces here that are important and that has happened. And then that is extended to organizations saying the same thing. There was a really dramatic shift when the Affordable Care Act was passed in Shasta County in that the numbers of people that now were eligible for Medi-Cal were enormous. Working people that did not have insurance, and all the clinics were just bombarded with demand, and that meant the ERs were overwhelmed. And that's a part of this story as well, is that there have to be other alternatives to emergency rooms when you're going through a mental health crisis, because they're just not equipped to serve that role. And mm-hmm. And that's the logjam has contributed to, you know, burnout within those settings, but also people not getting their needs met. And so that's a part of what we try to do too, is really have a clean process of evaluating who needs to be in the hospital versus who does not, who can be better served in through resources that exist elsewhere in the community, whether that's through us or the many other options. I mean, mental health is in high demand right now. Mental health services everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's waiting lists all over the place, but, mm-hmm. But there are resources other than the hospital, and that's kind of Nick's, that's his daily bread.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, Nick and John, to give people a sense of, you know, what happens when you pull up in the, you know, in the actual van, the actual mobile unit. You know, what kind of services are you providing? What does that look like? Clearly, it depends on individual needs, but to just give listeners a sense of what that's like.
It varies a lot. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it starts with some sort of de-escalation. Like we get called everywhere from, you know, somebody screaming on the side of the road, and we don't really know what we're walking into, to another common one is a family member whose family member just hasn't been acting the way that they usually do. There's been a sudden shift in their behavior and they're concerned. So it can start with a de-escalation. It can start with just that, with kindness, with rapport building, because a lot of times we're called by a family member and the other person isn't 100% sure. The person we're actually concerned about isn't 100% sure they want to engage with us. They're not sold yet. That's why they haven't come down to the care center. That's why they haven't engaged with other resources. And so we can come out to their space and just show them that we're not scary. And sometimes that's probably more often than not where it starts. And then we move forward from there.
In terms of resources that we're helping connect people to, the obvious one is the mental health services, getting folks connected to counseling, psychiatric care. But beyond that, it really varies incredibly. Oftentimes, the root of the crisis can be something medical. It can be a legal crisis. It can be housing. It can be, I don't know where I'm getting my next meal. So we really do attempt to assess what's the driver of the crisis, and then what are the additional needs to help get somebody that support. I am a little surprised at how many mental health crises with air quotes there really have at their root something medical or something that's really can be met really practically to resolve the crisis rather than needing intensive mental health support.
Can you give us an example of that, like a medical?
Yeah, so urinary tract infections can cause psychosis. Mm-hmm. Low hypothyroidism, if it's untreated, can cause psychosis. Those are the two that I've run into. Kidney, liver issues also can cause phytates to go to the brain, and that can cause psychosis. So oftentimes we'll get calls and somebody's describing, you know, we think this person has a mental health issue. They'll describe the behavior and we'll get out and it becomes evident that we really need an ambulance and to get this person to the hospital.
There's also been this summer a lot of people that have been more aggressive than, so you think about the heat and the dehydration, being dehydrated, maybe some heat exhaustion contributing to a change in behavior that is, you know, becomes of concern. And so somebody may call us or we often get calls routed directly from 911 dispatchers. And so if there's a call where somebody might need to be evaluated by a mental health provider and it doesn't seem like there's a danger to us as as the team going out. So if there's we screen for things like firearms, and if there's been recent violence or if they're behaving violently, then typically that's a call that law enforcement will go out to rather than us. But the bulk of the other calls we can take on and manage successfully, including doing the critical safety evaluations. Well, you know, what used to be called a welfare check, or you know, so if somebody's maybe needing to have a 5150 evaluation to be hospitalized involuntarily, we do that as well as and that might be for a grave disability due to psychosis or. And just inability to function, mm-hmm. But in many of those calls are due to suicidal ideation, mm-hmm. or recent acts, and so we get those kind of calls every day.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned dispatch, and we've certainly seen some national stories and other studies at the SCJC about. More and less effective, 911 dispatch, of knowing when to send a call to you. How is that working here, and what is needed for that effective routing?
Well, this was kind of a cool process just locally in trying to identify what would be the right kind of calls. I actually consulted with Cahoots up in Eugene to kind of say how does that break down. Eugene, the organization that operates the mobile crisis outreach teams there, the CAHOOTS team, they're the organization that operates the dispatching as well. So to all emergency services. So it's a unique setup up there. So we have a little bit different. So we really depended on our partnerships and working closely with, RPD, the Sheriff's Department, and with SHASCOM directly, which is operated, through the city. So we just kind of took the list of what other mobile crisis teams have responded to and kind of brainstormed and said, these are the things that we're able to do, maybe beyond what an embedded team that's with law enforcement can do because of our broad range of services, because we do this whole person approach. We're going to have a different set of resources and intentions and beyond the immediate safety issues. And we just developed a list of the types of calls, and that these were the definite yeses, these are the maybes, and then these are the nos. And the nos are minimal. Like, it's really the calls we don't go out on are very few. Those are the ones that would be routed to law enforcement instead, mm-hmm. or that just aren't, if somebody's calling for directions to their hotel,
right.
We'll tell them.
Right.
Just, we won't consider that a service. That'll just be a kindness.
Right. And I do have another question about who calls in, but you mentioned the de-escalation as one of your, you're assessing, de-escalating, referring to services. Are local law enforcement or others coming to you for de-escalation training? I know they have their own, but do you provide any of that training and how you do it, particularly with a population that's experiencing mental health crisis?
So the training that's done through law enforcement, mm-hmm. so that's specific for their crisis intervention teams, is different than what we do in many ways, because they are they're using, I think it's the same training that they do for hostage situations, mm-hmm. that sort of level of training is the same level, where they're looking at different factors. So there is the kind of talk types of de-escalation, but they're also looking at when do you use force and restrain people. And that's, we have our hearts in our heads and we don't even have a bulletproof jacket. So our tools are really focused in the area of building relationships. And so our training, the training that we have offered as a part of this, it's been mostly focused on our internally, and then some community offerings to other organizations around mental health first aid, which is really practical in terms of recognizing when somebody may be in distress, a very simple process is to see, you know, it's kind of, is somebody unsafe right now? Mm-hmm. And then trying to be a good listener and understand what's happening and offering to be of assistance in really practical ways and linking up with services. So that's a very, for anybody in the community, there are free trainings offered in that are full day.
The mental health first aid.
Yeah. Mental health first aid. And I think it's really been useful just to have, we have so many people in our community that have taken that training. And we've done just kind of a mini version of that. That's kind of get to the heart of it for other organizations where that may make referrals to us for which there may be people seeking help in some capacity and having a little extra confidence in how you're approaching it, you know, including like just checking your own reactions in a situation. If you're feeling afraid or you know, upset in some other way, it might be that you feel disgusted or angry, and those are emotions that repel us away from a situation rather than draw us in. And so it's kind of recognizing that in yourself and being willing. The term I use is being willing to dare to care, and staying in even though it feels uncomfortable, and to keep an open heart and an open mind to try and understand what's happening and be willing to help. And that help may be as simple as just having our number in your cell phone and calling us and doing a simple call and handoff.
Mm-hmm. And who is calling? I know I've talked to different people in the community and sometimes they have questions of, should I call? Who do I call? Is it dispatch that's connecting?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question because I think I'm not sure if this is something I should be calling about, or I'm not sure if this falls into your guys' area, is how I think a good chunk of our calls start. We have a lot of people who call and they say something along the lines of, I'm not sure if this is something you guys can help with, or I'm not sure if this person is having a crisis, but something seems off. And generally the answer to that is, we're the people that can assess that. So why don't we come out and have a conversation and see if we can be helpful in some way? Really, who calls is anybody. I mean, Tammy mentioned that we get dispatched through Shascom and 911 quite often for things that feel like maybe more appropriate for us than law enforcement. And so that's great because part of the goal is to just decrease the burden on some of these systems. If we can respond rather than law enforcement, that means law enforcement can be somewhere that's more relevant to them. And if we can get out and we can keep somebody out of the ER that doesn't need to be in the ER, that's great too. We get calls from businesses. We get calls from individuals concerned about a family member. We get calls from individuals concerned about themselves. So I don't know, we get calls from everybody.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find that those people also need support and referrals? Like, how do you manage that?
A lot of times, and this is where mobile crisis really stood out to me early on when I started, but I'm full-time clinician at the care center, and oftentimes the crisis was, my dad is behaving strangely, or my son has been using some sort of substances and now he's behaving oddly and I don't know what to do. And so often the crisis was, yes, I'm feeling overwhelmed and I'm in crisis, but, also one of my family members needs help and I can't get him to come down here, or I can't get her to come down here. And I don't know what to do. I'm feeling stuck. Or I don't know how to help them. And that's where mobile crisis is so relevant.
I think also, the number of parents who have adult children or younger, who they've been taken care of and they have serious mental illness. It's so, it's such a tremendous commitment to stick with someone who is struggling with a mental illness over the lifespan.
Yes.
And that those family members, it's often parents that are sticking it out the most. And that kind of both sense of obligation, but just unconditional love that is really lonely, and and you feel helpless, and have had failures over, you know, there's sort of systemic failures, there's personal sense of failure, just the sense of helplessness, and you know, a wide range of conditions that can contribute to that, and that there may have been hurts along the way that are really that have ripped families apart. So so yes, we have family members that they're calling and they want help for their child, but it's really shoring them up in their efforts that is the most impactful. And knowing, so they know that they have others available to help them. I mean, that I can't tell you just how many people are, they're just so grateful they have this little card with a number on it, and when things get really bad, they can get that help, or they can bring them into to our walk-in urgent mental health center. It's a really, I feel like, I mean, as somebody who had a family member with serious mental illness, completed suicide. I just think, I mean, I didn't intend for this to be a part of the story, but I just feel like every community everywhere should have available every day of the week, as we have in this community, somebody that can help if you're in trouble, if you or your family member's in trouble, somebody just, your neighbor, it doesn't matter, that there's a resource other than a cop showing up, that can help. And there are so many people in our community that struggle with suicidal thoughts every single day. We don't have immediate resources, immediate numbers in terms of the numbers, in terms of who is attempting or completing suicide. That right. data doesn't come out until years later, because they have to verify those sorts of things. And then the number of people that live with mental illness, and now that's more and more visible with as poverty, the housing resources, you know, our poverty rates can't keep up with the availability of affordable housing. So we've got lots and lots of people that are visible on the streets with mental illness or addiction or both, and those are, that's kind of a special population that we are trying to reach out to and engage and help stabilize and go on a different course. And we have so many stories of people that where it's been remarkable, the transition, but you can end up stuck on the streets for years and years because you've got a mental illness and you can't get out on your own.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN, community-supported radio, and I'm speaking to the Hill Country Community Clinic Mobile Crisis Outreach Team. And you mentioned, Tammy, the stories, and that's one of the things I wanted to be sure to ask you all, if you could give, within, you know, confidentiality, of course, but one or two examples of someone who you've seen who was assessed and connected to resources and the difference that it made.
Yeah, I think one that stood out kind of as we were talking earlier is I'm really thinking about a mother who had called about her son. Her son was using substances and had no intention of stopping, and she also had no intention of leaving him. You know, she was going to stick it out with him, as Tammy mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And she called us out multiple times, you know, with the idea of assessing him. And we met with him. He like I said, had really no intention of discontinuing what he was doing at this time. And that's where relationship building really comes in. What we were able to do in that situation was to provide support for the mother, while building a relationship with him, and that allowed her to continue living her life, and just sticking it out, or well, so that he was supported and housed while we built rapport, ultimately, he did get into a substance use treatment. Ultimately, our sort of approach with him, where we weren't trying to convince him or force him to do anything or make any changes he wasn't ready to make, led to some really interesting conversations. These ended up happening at the care center. Once we built enough of a relationship through Mobile Crisis, he did one day allow his mother to bring him down to the care center. And then there were more conversations there. But he did end up completing a treatment program, and you know, now he's been sort of connected to other resources in the community, which is sort of where you know, we stay available, but he's now connected to therapy and ongoing outpatient treatment and things like that. And and last I heard from him, which sometimes is an interesting thing at a crisis center, is that if you don't hear from them, sometimes it's a great thing. And so last I heard, he was doing really, really well.
Great.
I have a really quick one. It's just sort of a, you know, we had a situation that was somebody that had been involved with us with several organizations in the community this summer, who has serious mental health problems, also had relapsed into drinking, and during drinking episodes has been violent in the past. And so this is the kind of situation that you think is scary for everybody. And he made some threats that were pretty disturbing, that, you know, you can imagine if acted upon would there'd be some tragedies. So this kind of, those threats resulted in information being shared with law enforcement, but also with our mobile crisis team. And he had had previous encounters with the mobile crisis team, so there was sort of a everybody be on the lookout for him. And our staff were just going around, driving around, hunting to just try and catch him first, knowing that we had this pre-established connection and maybe it would prevent a tragedy of some kind, whether for him or for somebody else. Couldn't find him. And then he was spotted, and he literally had his arms waving in the air. He waved down the mobile crisis outreach team and was so grateful that they had found him, and was so sorry and regretful about his behavior and wanted to make amends, which is part of, you know, that's kind of the humanity in this, is to understand that we all have moments where we blow it in a big way, and hopefully you don't have an audience and for that, or have it turn into being, you know, something that changes the course of your life in a direction that you can't control. So, but he waved down. He ended up being hospitalized, stabilized, and is sober and is back on a good course with treatment and medications. It's really remarkable turnaround just through having that the availability of the resource and a connection. He actually said he would have called the mobile crisis team himself, but he didn't have a phone. He didn't, so he ended up back, he was housed and ended up on the streets. But so one of the first things that the mobile crisis team assisted with, when you think about on a practical level, what can we do that's different, is we assisted him in getting a phone that had taped the phone number for the mobile crisis team on it. Put it inside and outside so that even if the battery died, he would have the number and could have somebody help him make that call.
Nice. You know, and I didn't ask you before, and I didn't ask you to bring all of your data, but for listeners, what's the volume of calls, either, you know, kind of your average week or month or whatever makes sense?
So, we shoot for, like 250 calls a month is kind of a range. So you can think about, we try to get 10-ish a day. I mean, you think about what's the volume that we can manage. And we've been pretty consistent with that since early on. I mean, it was after just the first few months of rolling out we've been pretty consistent. There's some days that have been really busy. I think there was one of you that had our record day, I think like 20 calls in a day or something.
I think I held the record for about 3 days. Before we had a busier day.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, before it surpassed. Uh-huh. All right.
Yeah, those days are really tough. I mean, we really try to spend a good amount of time trying to understand what's going on and develop that rapport so that we can come back the next day. And we do follow up calls. So, you know, just because something gets wrapped up today, we're not done. We're going to continue to see people through whatever that crisis episode is until we know that they're engaged in follow-up care.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a system of support for each other, for the caregivers?
I think that's sort of baked into Hill Country's sort of MO. Mm. One of the things that was really surprising to me when I started at Hill Country is how much space was allowed for debriefing in our work. We all have a really kind of close group, and there's always sort of space and a willing person. And so we are kind of each other's support system, which works out really well. We're all right next to each other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, after a complicated case, usually we support each other and we make sure that we're checking in. And so I think the best support system for us is just sort of Hill Country's unique way of allowing us to be supports for each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also think that, for the long haul, like this is it's special work. It requires a special person, unique person to commit to doing this kind of work long term, and you can't do it for the long haul unless you have resources that fill your cup, and that's and that does mostly happen through the social experience with each other. There's a lot of love, our newest team member has been. Can speak probably more to that about what the difference has been from this setting to others.
Yeah, well, one just formal thing to mention is that Hill Country does have someone contracted to provide counseling to staff, so we can sign up for a slot anytime if there is a particularly hard case or the work stress is getting overwhelming. I really appreciate that. There's kind of no limit, no questions asked, and
nice,
which is vital, I think, to. In order to do this work long term, you really do need to get your own help, right? Mm-hmm. Every therapist should have a therapist, and we aren't excepted from that. In terms of the day to day support, yeah, there's been instances where Nick here has, I think Nick has seen that I've been a little bit tapped out and kind of checked in and come out to support. So there is a back and forth where we provide support to the care center when there's a particularly busy or stressful day, and they'll back us up when there's a need for that. And I think there's also a shared ethic or goal among the staff there that lends itself to, that makes it easier to reconnect with the why of the work. So that's something that's been really powerful for me.
Yeah.
Not only the ability to find a coworker and process or vent if you need to vent, but also the fact that Everyone at Hill Country kind of shares the same vision for why we do the work, and it makes it easier to reconnect to that for myself.
Great. You know, earlier you mentioned that when dispatch calls, sometimes it's RPD or the sheriff's office, sometimes it's you. But you also have a partnership with RPD. Is that correct, with their crisis response intervention team? What's that relationship, and what's your partnership with them?
So the process in our evolution, that law enforcement really wanted initially to have one of our clinicians be in patrol vehicles with them in that model, which is, there's lots and lots of good models like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the number of calls that you get that require that approach, really the volume isn't there, and they're really focused in on those high risk scenarios. So we opted for this other approach, which fit really well for us. But they are still that longing and the understanding on the part of law enforcement that they really needed to have specially trained officers and to have somebody in certain situations that was a mental health clinician that could do a better assessment than they could, and maybe connect in a different way. So they, along with us developing this resource, there was intention to develop this other team, the crisis intervention response team, where there are people who have firearms or knives, or who we've seen just locally situations with real extreme behavior, and having a specialty team that could respond in that situation and hopefully have it go well. So they developed that, but it has been a series of conversations over time that led to that, and we were at the table with as that evolved, there were a lot of bumps and hurdles to getting the the CERT team going. The crisis intervention response team is a long process, and I know a lot of frustration internally. But I've been a part of. I know these guys have been a part of those handoffs. You can share a story maybe on a situation. I have one from a few weeks ago, but.
Yeah, there's definitely overlap. I can think of a handful of calls where we end up out there and CERT is already there, or vice versa. CERT shows up while we're there, and then there's a really good conversation around who is best equipped to handle this. So there's overlap, and then there's also sort of they respond to some of these higher risk calls, the ones where there is threat of violence that we're not able to respond to, which is a really, really important thing. And then we're able to respond to some of the other stuff. And so there's a lot of collaboration and coordination and discussion of who's the best fit for what.
And when we're out on calls too, we have at times called to consult directly with the crisis intervention response team when things have started to escalate and it's begun to enter into that imminent danger zone. And they've been great in those situations to be able to help us consult, think through things, and see if a police response was needed for public safety purposes. I think, I love that we are separate from law enforcement at the same time. So there's a good collaboration and working relationship, but it's not a partnership in the sense that we, I think being separate and getting calls from dispatch where we get them and then it's our call gives us the flexibility to respond and work with situations where law enforcement has a certain orientation because of this, because they're there for public safety and to enforce the law. But to be really separate, just it allows us to respond with kindness, to Nick's point, and with flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that CERT has been surprised by just sort of how they've had to stretch. I mean, the needs that present during a crisis. There are times when they have been the right ones to help somebody get into treatment, not us. And that is our wheelhouse. Or to, figure out a housing situation. So there's been some really interesting programs that have evolved out of having the CERT team here that wouldn't have in their absence. And, I think when we first started, there was a lot of skepticism on the part of individual officers. It was... There wasn't anybody really, jumping and
like what a clapping. Great idea.
There was I think some skepticism both about Hill Country and about doing a mobile crisis team, maybe because of perceived cultural differences and suspicions, different ways of doing things.
Kind of organizational culture differences. Yeah. There's some differences there.
I think there are some differences. But I mean, when you enter into this work with a shared mission, and that's what I have felt like has been there consistently, is I haven't been in any conversation with any police officers where there wasn't consistency in our vision about where things should go. They don't want to use excessive force. That's not good for their psyche either. So they're reluctant. They've been increasingly appreciative over time of having us available as a resource so that they can focus on other things that they feel more capable of addressing and
kind of in their wheelhouse.
But also there's been, I think, a shift in compassion as well. There's kind of changes in understanding of human problems and the complexity involved when you if you're taking the time to listen, which is what the CERT team is doing more than a traditional officer that is untrained, then you get these rich stories in all their complexity, and you can't help but be moved by that and go into problem solving mode. And so I think there'll be continued good things that emerge out mm-hmm. of the work. I hope that the community and decision makers will value this kind of dual approach, because it's really synergistic, I think.
Mm-hmm. Is one of the differences, you know, I can imagine lots of different organizational cultural changes. And sometimes when you look in the community, it seems like there are very different ideas about public safety, like what we mean by public safety. Is there a conversation or some shared understanding around what that means?
Well, I mean, I think that that law enforcement is looking at things from is there a crime being committed, first off? Like this, that's kind of the first filter that we often hear is, mm-hmm. you know, if there's a crime, then they can do something, right? That's the first step for them, if whether or not there's a role for them. And then in terms of safety, it's a little bit fuzzy. You know, so and it's fuzzy for us too. There's a term called a 5149 and a half, where somebody doesn't quite meet criteria. Law enforcement use that term. We use that term.
Right.
It's not a situation where an involuntary hospitalization is appropriate, but there's somebody that's really not well and needs intense help and may not be willing. So that's complicated. It really does. I mean, I think we've evolved a dual approach, which is one to try and have there be some way to communicate genuine caring in that situation so that people feel that and begin to trust us. But the other part is about meeting some immediate need. You know, what does this person need today? How can we be helpful in some practical way? And that kind of a 1-2 punch of caring, authentically caring relationship combined with being useful is really powerful in those situations. And then we can typically divert away from these other systems and have the experience be transformative.
Mm-hmm. You know, and when we talk about kind of cultures and assumptions too, there's certainly a lot of rigorous stereotypes out there about what it means for people who are experiencing homelessness or being unsheltered or with an experience of substance abuse. What is important for community residents, for people new to law enforcement, to understand about the power of those stereotypes, or to understand about people with their intersectional identities? You know, how do you invite people into a deeper understanding of working with people in crisis?
I do think it's about, first off, recognizing yourself as being a potential helper, and that human beings we're far more caring than not, and that we tend to, that caring just has, it's like a rubber band. It's how far does it stretch? Who's inside the rubber band and who's outside of it? And if we can stretch that out and include people that we normally may not, maybe because of identified differences, maybe there's some fear or disgust or just revulsion or something that's different, and you're just not sure. It might just be just based on that otherness. Suspending that, allowing yourself to suspend that just as a human being and be willing to consider the other person's circumstances may be more complicated than it appears. Mm-hmm. And, it doesn't have to be you that does the intervention. That's the gift, I think, of having a service like this, is that somebody else is ready and willing and potentially could be successful in engaging them. But that's really the biggest hurdle, is that daring to step outside of your comfort zone and consider the humanity of that other person. We just get to listen to the most awesome stories. it's just remarkable. It's such a gift. It's such a gift to get to know people. And I feel grateful every day for getting to do this work, and to get to have those windows in, and sometimes to be helpful.
Mm. And, you know, at the SEJC, we really work with people like you. And I know, John and Nick, you are part of the coalition as well to help foster more equity and inclusion, particularly in the criminal legal system. But certainly our members are interested far beyond that. How, given what you... your experience and what you've learning, how do you invite people into conversations about being more curious, having more compassion, seeing people fully with all of their identities and experiences? How do you approach people who are initially resistant to understanding, say, someone who's experiencing, being unsheltered?
One thing I do is use person-first language whenever I talk about my work, whenever I have conversations about these issues. It's really important to talk about people who are experiencing homelessness, mm-hmm. or people who are unhoused, or people who live with mental illness, not mentally ill people or mm-hmm. homeless mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. but really to go to that person-first language, just to model that and encourage people into that way of thinking and recognizing the humanity mm-hmm. of the other. That And then the other piece, thinking about the way that I have conversation with folks who maybe come from a place of fear about those issues or a bit of judgment. It's hard for me to not go to a place of judgment also, but I think it's very important, exceptionally important to have open conversation in a way that allows that person to express and hopefully get a layer down to why they're holding that judgment. To maybe recognize some of the biases they have, to recognize some of the fears they may have around that. On the housing issue, right, many of us are living paycheck to paycheck and are one catastrophic loss away from homelessness. And I believe that a lot of people out there judge and push away folks they see on the street because there's this part of us that's like, that could be me, and I don't want to think about that, so it must have been something they did, right? Mm-hmm. There's this convenient cultural narrative that, if you're homeless, you must deserve it, right? Or it's a result of the poor choices, or you're choosing to be on the street. And I think having open conversation without judgment, asking good questions, and again, for me, using that person-first language, that's where I've seen bits of movement for some folks out there who maybe don't have a lot of understanding about. And I'll share stories too, specifically around housing. People will talk about, well, folks are choosing it, or they should have made better choices. And it's not always that overt in the conversation. But again, I'll just try to drop in stories about folks who've lost housing due to a domestic violence situation, mm-hmm. or a medical crisis that led to debt and eviction. I'll be explicit about that too, right? If people don't choose to get evicted, mm-hmm. and they don't choose to lose their job. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes that's what leads to losing shelter, losing housing.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate all that, not only coming here and having this conversation, but all the work that you do in our community, the super important work.
For folks that are wondering how they might be able to get involved and help with some of these issues, just remember that it's not just out there, it's with all of us. So check on your friends, family members, especially with COVID. I'm going to put an incredible amount of stress on many of us. And while it unified us in crisis, it also divided us in crisis. Mm-hmm. So don't be afraid to reach out to your neighbors, get to know your neighbors, check on them. Because again, it takes all of us, and none of us are immune to it. So, and don't hesitate to call us if you need that support.
This is KKRN, community-supported radio out of Round Mountain, California. And you can check us out on kkrn.org. You can donate, support, tell your friends. This is Bending the Arc.